Chapter 33. Somewhere Else Entirely. The book world was generally agreed to be only part of a much larger bookverse, but quite how big it was, and what percentage was unobservable, was a matter of hot debate among booklogians. The fundamental rules of the bookverse were also contentious. Some factions argued that the bookverse was constantly expanding as new books were written, but others argued convincingly of a steady-state bookverse, where ideas were endlessly recycled. A third faction, who called themselves simplists, argued that there was a single fundamental rule that governed all story. If it works, it works. The darkness drifted away like morning mist, leaving us hovering over a slate-grey sea with empty horizons in all directions. The sky was the same colour as the sea, and stretched across the heavens like a blanket, heavy and oppressive. A light breeze blew flecks of foam from the tops of the waves, and positioned not 30 feet below us was an old steamer of riveted construction. The vessel was making a leisurely pace through the waves, a trail of black smoke issuing languidly from her funnel, and the stern trailing a creamy wake as the ship rose and fell in the sea. "That'll be the Oberon," I said, craning my neck to see if I could spot Captain Carver in the wheelhouse. I couldn't. So I asked Worthless to move closer and try to land the rover on the aft hold cover so I could step aboard. She expertly moved the bus in behind the bridge and gently lowered it onto the boards, which creaked ominously under the weight. The door of the coach hissed open, and a strong whiff of salty air mixed with coal smoke drifted in. I could feel the rhythmic thump of the engine and the swell of the ocean through the decking. I took my bag and stepped from the rover, but I hadn't gone 3 paces when all of a sudden I realized there was something badly wrong. This ship wasn't the Oberon. And if that was the case, this book certainly wasn't Dark and Stormy Night. "Okay, we've got a problem," I said, turning back to the rover, only to find Dr. Worthless standing in the doorway, holding a pistol and smiling. "Bollocks," I muttered, which was about as succinct as I could be, given the sudden change of circumstance. "Bollocks, indeed," replied Dr. Worthless. "We've waited over 15 years for this moment." "Before now, I'd always thought patience was a virtue," I murmured, "not the secret weapon of the vengeful." She shook her head and smiled again. "You're exactly how he described you, an ardent moralist, a goody-two-shoes, pathologically eager to do what's best and what's right." She looked around at the ship, which heeled in the swell. "So, this place is particularly apt, and the perfect place for you to spend the rest of your pitifully short life." "What do you want?" "Nothing. Nothing at all. With you trapped here, we have everything I want. We'll be off to the Hesperus now, Miss Next, to find that recipe." "You know about the unscrambled eggs?" I asked, shocked at the sudden turn of events. "We're Goliath," she said simply. "And information is power. With the end of time due tomorrow evening, it will be something of a challenge. But listen, I like a challenge, and I have the knowledge of your defeat to freshen my mind and make the task that much more enjoyable." "You'll never find it," I said. "Longfellow is at the other end of the book world, and poetry is the place you'll discover." I checked myself. I wasn't helping these people, no matter how acute the perils.
"Discover what?" asked Worthless with a frown.
"Never mind."
"We'll be fine," she replied. "We just needed your expertise to make the initial jump. We're not quite so stupid as you think."
I couldn't believe that I'd been hoodwinked by Goliath again. I had to hand it to them. This plan had been hatched and executed beautifully.
"How long have you known about the recipe?" That's just the weirdest thing of it, Dr. Worthless smiled. On the one hand, only a day, but on the other, over 15 years. Retrospective investment, I whispered, suddenly understanding. In their desperation, the ChronoGuard was breaking every single rule they'd ever made. Right. The Star Chamber lost confidence in your son's ability to secure the future. So they called Lavoisier out of retirement to see if there weren't other avenues to explore. He approached John Henry yesterday at breakfast time to ask him if the long-abandoned book project could be brought up to speed. Since it couldn't, Lavoisier suggested that they restart the project 15 years ago so it could be ready for the end of time tomorrow evening. John Henry agreed, with certain conditions, and I must say, we only just made it. This is something of a mind fuck, I replied, with no possibility of understatement. What does Goliath get out of it? How do you think we survived being taken over by the Toast Marketing Board? 2 days ago, Goliath was just a bad memory, with John Henry in debtor's prison and me working for International Pencils. When you have friends in the time industry, anything is possible. The ChronoGuard will be willing to offer us almost untold patronage for the recipe to unscramble eggs, and with it, the secret to travel in time. And in return, a corporation allowed to speculate freely in time. Finally, we will be able to bring our big plan to fruition. And that plan is to own everything. In a world with a short now? Of course. With a compliant population only interested in the self and instant gratification, we can flog all manner of worthless crap as the latest thing to have. There'll be big profits next, and by subtly choosing from whom the now is mined, the long now Uber class can sit back and enjoy the benefits that will be theirs, and theirs alone. I stared at Worthless, wondering if I could rush her. It seemed doubtful, since I was at least 10 feet away, and the two technicians still on board the rover also looked as if they had weapons. Okay, said the doctor. We're all about done here. Enjoy your imprisonment. You'll know what it was like for my husband. 2 years in the Raven next. 2 years! He still has nightmares, even today. You're Jack Shit's wife? She smiled again. Now you're getting it. My full name is Dr. Anne Worthless Shit. But if you'd known, it might have been a bit of a giveaway. Hmm? Bye-bye now. The door swung shut. The bell rang twice. There was a low hiss, and the Austin Rover lifted off. They hovered for a moment, and then slowly rotated, expertly missed the crane derrick, rose above the height of the funnel, and then became long and drawn out like a piece of elastic before vanishing with a faint pop. I was left standing on the deck, biting my lip in frustration and anger. I took a deep breath and calmed myself. The reality book show of the Bennetts wasn't due to start until tomorrow morning, so there was always hope. I looked around. The steamer rolled gently in the swell. The smoke drifted across the stern, past the fluttering red ensign, and the beat of the engine echoed up through the steel deck. I knew I wasn't in dark and stormy night, because the ship wasn't a rusty old tub held together by paint. But I was certainly somewhere. And somewhere was better than nowhere. It was only when I arrived there and was out of ideas, time, and essential metabolic functions that I was going to give up. I trotted up the companionway, ducked into the galley, and made my way up the ladder to the bridge, where a boy not much older than Friday was holding the ship's wheel. "Who's in command?" I asked, a bit breathless. "Why, you, of course," replied the lad. I'm not.
Then why are you wearing the cap?
I put up my hands to check, and strangely enough, I was wearing the captain's cap. I took it off and stared at it stupidly.
What book is this?
No book I knows of, Captain. What be your orders?
I looked out of the wheelhouse ahead, but could see nothing except a grey sea meeting a grey sky. The light was soft and directionless, and for the first time I felt a shiver of dread. Something about this place was undeniably creepy, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I went to the navigation desk and looked at the chart. There was nothing on it but the pale blueness of open ocean, and a cursory look in the drawers of the desk told me that every chart was the same. Whatever this place was, this was all there was of it. I had to assume I was somewhere in the maritime genre, but a quick glance at my mobile footnoter phone and the absence of any signal told me that I was several thousand volumes beyond our repeater station in the Hornblower series. And if that was the case, I was right on the periphery of the genre. As good as lost. I tapped my finger on the desk and thought hard. Panic was the mind killer, and I still had several hours to figure this out. If I was no further on in 10 hours' time, then I could panic.
"What are your orders, Captain?" asked the lad at the wheel again.
"What's your name?"
"Baldwin."
"I'm Thursday. Thursday next."
"Good to know you, Captain Next.
Have you heard my name? Or of jurisfiction?"
He shook his head.
"Right. Tell me, Baldwin, do you know this ship well?"
"As well as I know myself," he replied proudly.
"Is there a core containment room?"
"Not that I knows of."
"So we weren't in a published work. How about a story code engine anywhere on board?" He frowned and looked confused.
"There's an ordinary engine room. I don't know nothing about no story code."
I scratched my head. Without a story code engine, we were either non-fiction or something in the oral tradition. Those were the upbeat possibilities. I might also be in a forgotten story, a dead writer's unrealized idea, or even a handwritten short story stuck in a desk drawer somewhere. The dark reading matter.
"What year is this?"
"Spring of 1932, Captain."
"And the purpose of this voyage?"
"Not for the likes of me to know, Captain."
"But something must happen."
"Oh, aye," he said more confidently. "Things most definite happen."
"What sort of things?"
"Difficult things, Captain." As if in answer to his enigmatic comment, someone shouted my name. I walked out onto the port wing, where a man in a first officer's uniform was on the deck below. He was in his mid-50s and looked vaguely cultured, but somehow out of place, as though his service in the Merchant Navy had been to remove him from problems at home.
"Captain Next," he said.
"Yes, sort of."
"First Officer William Fitzwilliam, at your service, ma'am. We've got a problem with the passengers."
"Can't you deal with it?"
"No, ma'am. You're the captain."
I descended and met Fitzwilliam at the foot of the ladder. He led me into the panelled wardroom, where there were three people waiting for us. The first man was standing stiffly, with his arms folded, and looked aggrieved. He was well dressed in a black morning coat and wore a small pince-nez perched on the end of his nose. The other two were obviously man and wife. The woman was of an unhealthy pallor, had recently been crying, and was being comforted by her husband, who every now and then shot an angry glance at the first man. "I'm very busy," I told them. "What's the problem here?"
"My name is Mr. Langdon," said the married man, wringing his hands. "My wife, Louise, here, suffers from Zachary's syndrome, and without the necessary medicine, she will die."
"I'm very sorry to hear that," I said, "but what can I do?"
"That man has the medicine," cried Langdon, pointing an accusatory finger at the man in the pince-nez. "Yet he refuses to sell it to me."
"Is this true?"
"My name is Dr. Glister," said the man, nodding politely.
I have the medicine, it is true, but the price is 2,000 guineas, and Mr. and Mrs. Langdon have only 1,000 guineas, and not the capacity to borrow more.
Well, I said to the doctor, I think it would be a kindly gesture to lower the price, don't you?
I wish I could, replied Dr. Glister, but this medicine cost me everything I possessed to develop. It destroyed my health and damaged my reputation. If I do not recoup my losses, I will be forced into ruin. My property will be repossessed, and my 6 children will become destitute. I am sympathetic to Mrs. Langdon's trouble, but this is a fiscal issue.
Listen, I said to the Langdons, it's not up to me. The medicine is Dr. Glister's property, for him to dispose of as he wishes.
But she needs the medicine now, pleaded Mr. Langdon. If she doesn't get it, she will die. You are the captain on this ship, and so have the ultimate authority. You must make the decision.
I sighed. I had a lot more important things to deal with right now.
Dr. Glister, give him the medicine for 1,000 guineas. Mr. Langdon, you will work to repay Dr. Glister no matter what. Understood?
But my livelihood, wailed Glister.
I place Mrs. Langdon's definite death above the possibility of your penury, Dr. Glister.
But this is nothing short of theft, he replied, outraged at my words. And I have done nothing wrong, only discovered a cure for a fatal illness. I deserve better treatment than this.
You do, you're right. But I know nothing of you, nor the Langdons. My decision is based only on the saving of a life. Will you excuse me? Baldwin had called from the wheelhouse, and I quickly scooted up the stairs.
What is it?
He pointed to something about a mile off the starboard bow. I picked up a pair of binoculars and trained it on the distant object.
Finally, some good luck.
It looked like a turmoil, the name we gave to a small, localized disruption in the fabric of the written word. This was how heavy weather in the book world got started. A turmoil would soon progress into a powerful word storm, able to uproot words, ideas, and even people, then carry them with it across the empty darkness of the nothing, eventually dumping them on distant books several genres distant. It was my way out. I'd never hitched a ride on a word storm before, but it didn't look too difficult. Dorothy, after all, had no real problems with the tornado.
Alter course to starboard 30 degrees, I said. We're going to intercept the word storm.
How long do you think it will take for us to get there, Baldwin?
20 minutes, Captain.
It would be a close thing. Turmoils increase their pace until a rotating tube rises up into the heavens, filled with small sections of plot and anything else it can suck up. Then, with a flurry of distorted sense, it lifts off and vanishes. I wouldn't get this chance again.
Is that wise, Captain? Asked First Officer Fitzwilliam, who had joined us on the bridge.
I've seen storms like that. They can do serious damage, and we have 40 passengers, many of them women and children.
Then you can lower me in a lifeboat ahead of the storm.
And leave us with no lifeboat?
Yes.
No.
I don't know.
Fitzwilliam?
Yes, Captain.
What is this place?
I don't know what you mean, Captain.
I mean...
Captain, said Baldwin, pointing off of the port side of the ship. Isn't that a lifeboat?
I turned my attention to the area in which he pointed. It was a lifeboat, and what looked like several people, all slumped and apparently unconscious.
Damn.
I looked again, hoping for confirmation that they might already be dead, but saw nothing to tell me either way. I frowned to myself. Had I just hoped for them to be dead?
You can pick them up after you've dropped me off, I said. It'll only mean an extra 40 minutes for them, and I really need to get out of here.
I saw Fitzwilliam and Baldwin exchange glances. But as we watched, the lifeboat was caught by a wave and capsized, casting the occupants into the sea. We could see now that they were alive, and as they scrabbled weakly to cling to the upturned boat, I gave the order.
Turn about, reduce power, and stand by to pick up survivors.
Aye, aye, Captain,
said Baldwin, spinning the wheel as Fitzwilliam rung up slow ahead on the engine room telegraph. I walked out onto the starboard wing and watched despondently as the turmoil developed into a word storm. Within the 20 minutes it took to intercept the lifeboat, the whirling mass of narrative distortion lifted off, taking part of the description of the ocean with it. There was a ragged, dark hole for an instant, and then the sea washed in to fill the anomaly, and in a few moments everything was back to normal. Perhaps I should have left the lifeboat. After all, the Long Now and the Classics were more important than several fictional castaways. Mind you, if I'd been on that lifeboat, I know what I would have wanted.
Captain?
It was Dr. Glister. I don't want to know about your argument with the Langdons, I told him.
No, no, he replied in something of a panic. You cannot pick up these castaways.
Why not?
They have Squirt's disease.
They have what? We walked into the wheelhouse and out again onto the port wing, where Fitzwilliam was directing the rescue operation. The lifeboat was still ahead of us, at least 100 yards. The ship was moving forward slowly. A cling net had been thrown over the side, and several burly sailors were making ready to pick up the castaways.
"Look carefully at the survivors," urged Dr. Glister,
and I trained my binoculars on the small group. Now that they were closer, I could see that their faces were covered with unsightly green pustules. I lowered the binoculars and looked at Dr. Glister.
"What's the prognosis?"
100% fatal and highly contagious. Bring them on board, and we'll be looking at a minimum of 20% casualties. We don't reach port for 6 months, and these poor wretches will have died in agony long before we can get any help to them.
I rubbed my temples. "You're completely sure of this?" He nodded. I took a deep breath.
"Fitzwilliam?"
"Yes, Captain?"
"Break off the rescue."
"What?"
"You heard me.
These people have a contagious, fatal illness, and I won't risk my passengers' lives saving castaways who will die no matter what we do."
"But, Captain," he protested, "we never leave a man in the water."
"We're doing it today, Fitzwilliam. Do you understand?" He glared at me menacingly, then leaned over the rail and repeated my order, making sure the men knew who had made it. After that, he went into the wheelhouse, rang up full ahead, and the vessel shuddered as we made extra speed and steamed on.
"Come inside," said Dr. Glister.
"No," I said, "I'm staying here. I won't hide from the men I've condemned to death." And I stood there and watched as the lifeboat and the men drifted astern of the ship and were soon lost to view in the seas. It was with a heavy heart that I walked back into the wheelhouse and sat in the captain's chair. Baldwin was silent, gazing straight ahead.
"It was the right thing to do," I muttered, to no one in particular. "And what's more, I could have used the word storm to escape after all."
"Things happen here," muttered Baldwin. "Difficult things."
I suddenly had a thought, but hoped upon hope I was wrong.
"What's the name of this ship?"
"The ship?" replied Baldwin cheerily.
"It's the steamship Moral Dilemma, Captain."
I covered my face with my hands and groaned. Anne Worthless Shit and her obnoxious husband had not been kidding when they said they'd chosen this place especially for me. My nerves were already badly frayed, and I felt the heavy hand of guilt pressing upon me. I'd only been here an hour. What would I be like in a week or a month? Truly, I was trapped in an unenviable place, adrift on the hypothetical ocean, in command of the moral dilemma.
"Captain?"
It was the cook this time. He was unshaven and wearing a white uniform that had so many food stains on it, it was hard to say where stain ended and uniform began.
"Yes," I said, somewhat wearily.
"Begging your pardon, but there's been a gross underestimation on the provisions."
"And?"
"We don't get into port for another 6 months," the cook continued, referring to a grubby sheet of calculations he had on him. "And we only have enough to feed the crew and passengers on strict rations for 2/3 of that time."
"What are you saying?"
"That all 40 of us will starve long before we reach port." I beckoned Fitzwilliam over.
There wouldn't be another port closer than that, would there?
No, Captain, he answered. Port Conjecture is the only port there is.
I thought so.
And no fish, either?
Not in these waters.
Other ships?
None.
I got it now. These were the difficult things Baldwin had spoken of. And they were mine, and mine alone to deal with. The ship, the sea, and the people on it might be hypothetical, but they could suffer and die the same as anyone.
Thank you, Cook, I said. I'll let you know of my decision.
He gave a lazy salute and was gone.
Well, Fitzwilliam, I said, doing some simple math on a piece of paper. There's enough food for 26 people to survive until we reach port. Do you think we could find 14 volunteers to throw themselves over the side to ensure the survival of the rest?
I doubt it.
Then I have something of a problem. Is my primary sense of duty as captain to see to it that as many people as possible survive on my ship? Or is it my moral obligation not to conduct or condone murder?
The men in the lifeboat just now wouldn't see you as anything but a murderer.
Perhaps so, but this one's harder. It's not a case of inaction to bring about a circumstance, but action. This is what I'm going to do. Anyone under 18 is excluded, as are 6 essential crew to keep the ship going. All the rest will choose straws. 13 will go over the side. If they don't want to go, then I will throw them over.
You'll hang for it.
I won't. I'll be the 14th.
Very selfless, murmured Fitzwilliam.
But even after your crew and age exclusions, 31 passengers are still under 18. You will still have to select 7 of them.
Will you be able to throw them overboard? The children? The innocents?
But I save the rest, right?
It's not for me to say, said Fitzwilliam quietly. I am not the captain.
I closed my eyes and took a deep breath, my heart thumping and a cold panic roiling inside me. I had to do terrible things in order to save others, and I'm not sure I could even do it, and thus imperil everyone's life. I stopped for a moment and thought. The dilemmas had been getting progressively worse since I arrived. Perhaps this place, wherever it was quirkily responsive to my decisions. I decided to try something.
No, I said. I'm not going to kill anyone simply because an abstract ethical situation demands it. We're going to sail on as we are, and trust to Providence that we meet another ship. If we don't, then we may die. But we will have at least done the right thing by one another.
There was a distant rumble of thunder in the distance, and the boat heeled over. I wondered what would be next.
Begging your pardon, Captain, but I bring bad news.
It was a steward whom I hadn't seen before.
And?
We have a gentleman in the wardroom who claims there is a bomb on board the ship, and it's set to go off in 10 minutes.
I allowed myself a wry smile. The rapidly changing scenarios seemed to have a clumsy intelligence to them. It was possible this was something in the oral tradition. But I couldn't be sure. If this small world were somehow sentient, though, it could be beaten. To vanquish it, I needed to find its weakness, and it had just supplied one. Impatience. It didn't want a long, drawn-out starvation for the passengers. It wanted me to commit a hands-on murder for the greater good. And soon.
Show me.
I followed the steward into the wardroom, where a man was sitting in a chair in the middle of the room. He looked sallow, and had fine, wispy blonde hair and small eyes that stared intently at me as I walked in. A burly sailor named McTavish, who was tattoo and Scotsman in a 3-to-4 ratio, was standing guard over him. There was no one else in the room. There didn't need to be. It was a hypothetical situation.
Your name, sir?
Jebediah Salford, and I have a hidden bomb.
I heard. And naturally, you won't tell me where it is.
Naturally.
This bomb, I went on, will sink the ship,
potentially leading to many deaths?
Indeed, I hope so, replied Jebediah cheerily.
Your own included?
I fear no death.
I paused for thought. It was a classic and overused ethical dilemma. Would I, as an essentially good person, reduce myself to torturing someone for the greater good? It was a puzzle that had been discussed for many years, generally by those to whom it has no chance of becoming real. But the way in which the scenarios came on thick and fast suggested that whoever was running this show had a prurient interest in seeing just how far a decent person could be pushed before doing bad things. I could almost feel the architect of the dilemma gloating over me from afar. I would have to stall him if I could.
Fitzwilliam, have all passengers go on deck, close all watertight doors, and have every crew member and able-bodied passenger look for the bomb.
Captain, he said, that's a waste of time. There is a bomb, but you can't find it.
The decision has to be made here and now in this wardroom.
Damn. Outmaneuvered.
How many lifeboats do we have? I asked, getting increasingly desperate.
Only one left, ma'am, with room for 10.
Shit. How long do we have before this bomb goes off?
7 minutes.
If this were the real world, and in a situation as black and white as this, there wasn't a decision to make, I would use all force necessary to get the information. But, most important, submit myself to scrutiny afterward. If you permit or conduct torture, you must be personally responsible for your actions. It's the kind of decision where it's best to have the threat of prison looming behind you. But the thing was, on board this ship, here and now, it didn't look as though torturing him would actually achieve anything at all. He would eventually tell me, the bomb would be found, and the next dilemma would begin. And they would carry on, again and again, worse and worse, until I had done everything I would never have done, and the passengers of this vessel were drowned, eaten, or murdered. It was hell for me, but it would be hell for them, too. I sat down heavily on a nearby chair, put my head in my hands, and stared at the floor.
Captain, said Fitzwilliam, we only have 5 minutes. You must torture this person.
Yeah, yeah, I mumbled incoherently. I know.
We will all die, he continued.
Again.
I looked up into his eyes. I'd never noticed how incredibly blue they were.
You all die in the end, don't you? I said miserably. No matter what I do. It's just one increasingly bad dilemma after another, until everyone's dead, right?
4 minutes, Captain.
Am I right?
Fitzwilliam looked away.
I asked you a question, number one.
He looked up at me, and he seemed to have tears in his eyes.
We have all been drowned, he said in a quiet voice, over 1,000 times each. We have been eaten, blown up, and suffered fatal illnesses. The drowning's the worst. Each time I can feel the smothering effect of the water, the blind panic as I suffocate.
Fitzwilliam, I demanded, where is this damnable place?
He took a deep breath and lowered his voice.
We're oral tradition, but we're not in a story. We're an ethics seminar.
You mean you're all hypothetical characters during a lecture?
Fitzwilliam nodded miserably. The steward, somewhat chillingly, handed me a pair of pliers, while reminding me in an urgent whisper that there were only 3 minutes left.
I looked down at the pliers in an absent sort of way, at Jebediah, then back to Fitzwilliam, who was staring at the floor.
So much suffering on board this ship, and for so long. Perhaps there was another way out.
The thing was, to take such radical action in the oral tradition risked the life of the lecturer giving the talk.
But what was more important? The well-being of one real-life ethics professor, or the relentless torture of his subjects, who had to undergo his sadistic and relentless hypothetical dilemmas for 2-hour sessions 3 times a week?
When you tell a tragic story,
someone dies for real in the book world. I was in the oral tradition, potentially the best storytelling there was, and the most destructive.
McTavish, prepare the lifeboat for launching. I'm leaving.
McTavish looked at Fitzwilliam, who shrugged, and the large Scotsman and his tattoos departed.
This isn't one of the options, said Fitzwilliam. You can't do it.
I have experience of the oral tradition, I told him. All these scenarios are taking place only because I am here to preside in judgment upon them. This whole thing goes just one way, in a downward spiral of increasingly impossible moral dilemmas that will leave everyone dead, except myself and one other, whom I will be forced to kill and eat or something. If I take myself out of the equation, you are free to sail across the sea unhampered, unimpeded, and safe.
But that might
harm the lecturer, even kill him?
Possibly. If the bomb goes off, you'll know I've failed, and he's okay. If it doesn't, you'll all be safe.
And you? He asked. What about you?
I patted him on the shoulder.
Don't worry about me. I think you've all suffered enough on account of the Outland.
But surely, we can pick you up again if all goes well.
No, I said. That's not how it works. It can't be a trick. I have to cast myself adrift.
I trotted out of the wardroom and to the side of the ship, where McTavish had already lowered the lifeboat. It was being held against the scramble net by lines fore and aft, clutched by deckhands, and it thumped against the hull as the waves caught it. As I put my leg over the rail to climb down, Fitzwilliam grasped my arm. He wasn't trying to stop me. He wanted to shake me by the hand.
Goodbye, Captain, and thank you.
I smiled.
Think you'll make Porter Conjecture?
He smiled back.
We'll give it our best shot.
I climbed down the scramble net and into the lifeboat. They let go fore and aft, and the boat rocked violently as the bow wave caught it. For a moment, I thought it would go over, but it stayed upright, and I rapidly fell behind as the ship steamed on. I counted off the seconds until the bomb was meant to explode, but thankfully it didn't. And across the sea, I heard the cheer of 40 people celebrating their release. I couldn't share in their elation, because in a university somewhere back home, the ethics lecturer had suddenly keeled over with an aneurysm. They'd call a doctor, and with a bit of luck he'd pull through. He might even lecture again, but not with this crew. The moral dilemma was at least a quarter mile away by now, and within 10 minutes the steamer was just a smudge of smoke on the horizon. In another half hour it had vanished completely, and I was on my own in a grey sea that lasted forever in all directions. I looked through my shoulder bag and found a bar of chocolate, which I ate in a despondent manner, and then just sat in the bow of the lifeboat and stared up at the grey sky, feeling hopelessly lost. I leaned back and closed my eyes. Had I done the right thing? I had no idea. The lecturer couldn't have known the suffering he was putting his hypothetical characters through. But even if he had, perhaps he'd justify it by reasoning that the suffering was worth the benefit to his students. If he survived, I'd be able to ask him his opinion. But that wasn't likely. Rescue seemed a very remote possibility, and that was at the nub of the whole ethical dilemma argument. You never come out on top, no matter what. The only way to win the game is not to play.